Psalm 62, verses 1 and 2. For God alone my soul waits in silence. From Him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly moved. Those are hard verses, I think, for most of us, because they call us to wait upon God, and we're not a waiting kind of culture. Most of us have a sense that if things are going to get done in life, I'm going to have to get out there and do them myself. And so to some degree, God may not move fast enough, or He may not move with enough certainty, or He may not work in the right regions for us. And so we get out there and perhaps try to do it on our own. Once we turn that corner and get out from under the concepts of Psalm 62, we find ourselves in the fast lane. Sometimes the harder and the longer we work, the more frustrating life becomes. And many times we live with the expectation that next week the hours will be cut back, or next month the pressures will be down, or sometime early next year the demands will be lower. There are really two things, I think, going on here. One is the process of working and making a living. And the other is our attitude or our perspective toward life in general. And it may be that in leaving aside concepts like Psalm 62, that we are really leaving behind a perspective in life that's actually quite helpful. We see some of this going on in Genesis 11. At one point in the ancient Near East, there was a spooky sight. It was a tall, unfinished structure towering over a dusty plain. Piles of construction materials were scattered around. Grass had grown up through the access roads. It could have been the world's first skyscraper. But the construction was halted because problems developed among the planning committee that led to insurmountable difficulties in the labor force. When we read the story by itself, we may think that it's just the story of how a stub of a skyscraper came to be sitting on the Babylonian plain, or perhaps a story of how at one time all the world's different languages were just one, and now we have many, and this is the explanation of how they began. So when we read this particular episode in light of the first 11 chapters of Genesis, we get slightly a different picture, thus a different meaning. Part of the picture is, according to Genesis 1 through 11, God wanted people to scatter over all the earth. The Towers Committee said, let's not be scattered. And so let's build us a monument to ourselves, and let's go in a different direction than one God wants to go. That was not an idle threat. They could have done it, the text tells us. They could have changed the face of all reality and made this a human-centered rather than a God-centered planet. If they had built the tower, nothing would have been impossible for the rulers of that tower. There's another perspective in Genesis 1 through 11 that enters in here, and that is the struggle between God and the people to determine who's in charge. God's in charge when Genesis opens. But God makes it clear He's willing to share that power. You can subdue the earth, He tells the first people. You can be in charge of filling it with people. You can create civilization and the arts and the sciences. You can create colonies all over the globe. Yet, despite those rather generous concessions of power, these people wanted more. They had the horizontal. Now they wanted the vertical. And that by the tower, they seemed to be saying that they wanted it all. In fact, they were saying that they had started it all, for they had forgotten that the very source of the tower, the bricks and the mortar, was from some other source. Well, when we see that, we see that they had taken life into their own hands, like we sometimes do. And they had decided that if all the people are going to be together in one place, it's up to us. If we're going to get anywhere in this planet, we need this tower. And once it's in place, then life will be okay. Well, there are a number of problems, I think, at work here in Genesis 1 through 11. I want to underline two this morning. Issues that maimed these people in their perspective on life. And if we can see ourselves in them and see what they missed, then perhaps we can make some adjustments and move on to a more successful life ourselves. The first problem that was working in the Genesis 11 story was a problem of profound selfishness. They said, let's make a name for ourselves. There's a pride, a greed, a narcissism at work there. The purpose of this tower was not to find God. It was not to glorify God. It was not to call people to faith. It was not to remind them of another world. It was not to be a place of prayer. But it was built out of 100% selfishness. Hunter Thompson is a columnist for the San Francisco Examiner newspaper. He recently came out with a collection of his writings under the title of Generation of Swine. And at one point, he describes our culture and our land with these words. He says, huge brains, small necks, weak muscles, and fat wallets. Those are the dominant characteristics of the 80s, the generation of swine. Well, that notion has been well documented in our own time, but that's not really the issue that faces us here. What was it that was lacking in the tower builders that's missing in our own perspective? What is the antidote to greed? Well, biblically, the opposite of selfishness is gratitude. Selfishness says, I desire what comes to me. Other people ought to make me happy. But the opposite is the recognition that benefits come to our lives from two different sources. They come from God and they come from others. And perhaps one of the things that leads to more frustration and more anxiety in our lives than anything else is this stunted and impoverished sense of gratitude. We often pray for blessings before events happen, and that's quite adequate, that's quite proper. But it's sometimes hard to separate out those requests for blessings from our own selfishness. And it's only in the backward act of thanksgiving and prayer that we're finally freed from that greed. One of the men who has modeled the Christian life for me is Raymond Doggett. When the two of us lived in the same town, Raymond traveled a great deal. And he used to tell me, by way of confession, Harold, every time I get ready to take a trip, I pray for my safety. I pray as I get on the plane. I pray as the plane taxis down the runway. I pray as it lands. Yet when I get back home in my living room on my own couch, I forget to thank God for the safe trip. Well, he wasn't talking about something mechanical in his life, but he was talking about a perspective, about an attitude, a switch from greed and selfishness to one of thanksgiving and gratitude. In Lee Iacocca's autobiography, he tells of how his wife, Mary, was his greatest fan and cheerleader. She had diabetes, yet she was always at his side. When he was fired from Ford, she was there. When he was offered the job of saving Chrysler, she said, I love you, and I believe you can do anything you set your mind to do. 2 weeks before she died, she called Iacocca, who was on a business trip, to tell him how proud she was of him. Later he said, Mary sustained me. And then he went on to say, yet during those last few difficult years, I never once told her how proud I was of her. Well, there's nothing wrong with building a tower, but there was something significant missing in the hearts of the architects. And we can be like them in so many ways. We pull ourselves up. We benefit from the work of others. We plow into things for more and more. We expand and we build and we take and we shake and we move. And in that process, we sometimes forget what others have done, and we go on building the tower to our own destruction. Gary Smalley has a book out called For Better or For Best. It's a book that I ask couples to read before they marry. He cites in that book a survey taken among 1,000 workers. They asked them, what can your employer do, or what does your employer do to motivate you to work harder? Well, the employers were surprised that the number one response had nothing to do with benefits, nothing to do with income. But the majority of the workers said that the one thing their employers did to make them want to work harder was to express appreciation for individual efforts. Well, selfishness is rampant because we are by nature forgetters. Selfishness runs without restraint because we think we got here by ourselves. Selfishness spreads without bounds because gratitude is often not part of our lives. There's a story about a boat accident on Lake Michigan. Rescue teams came from Chicago, Milwaukee. One of the teams was from Northwestern University in Evanston. One member of that student team was Edward Spencer, and he, before the day was over, rescued 16 or 17 people out of the lake, out of that mishap. Years later, there was a reunion at Northwestern University, and the speaker recalled the incident of the rescue. Someone in the audience interrupted and said, Edward Spencer's here today, and they called him to the front. He was old, gray-haired, bent over. When he got on the stage, the speaker said, Mr. Spencer, what do you most remember about that great day of rescue? He said that out of the 16 or 17 people that I rescued out of the water that day, the thing that I most remember is that not one of them thanked me. It's strange, isn't it, in a world that has become so fast and so expensive, that one of the easiest and simplest and least expensive things to do is the one that's often overlooked. And the overlooking of it makes us into tower builders. intent on ourselves, focused on our greed, centered on our own pride and our own needs. Behind the successes and accomplishments of each person in this room is a long line of people who have served us and helped us and promoted us and taught us and given to us. A sense of gratitude is a key element in becoming a full person and becoming a Christian person and becoming a fulfilled person that knows what life is really about. Kipling, the famous author who died in 1936, was one of the most popular writers of his time, wrote Wee Willie Winkie, won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1907. Word got around that he received 50 cents for every word that he wrote. Some Oxford students, perhaps less impressed with his ability than they should have been, sent Kipling 50 cents with this request: please send us back one of your best words. Immediately, Kipling cabled the students a one-word message. The cable said, thanks. Well, there's a perspective on life wrapped up in that little word, thanks, that can make a great deal of difference in the way we live. Yet there's a second thing missing, I think, in the lives of the tower builders back in Genesis 11. They were unable to control themselves. Once they got started on this project, they couldn't stop. They wanted more and more. There were no restraints, no governors. The thing that they was missing, secondly, was a sense of self-discipline. And it's the other perspective that controls the greed and the selfishness and the narcissism of our lives. It was blind ambition on the plain outside of Babylon. Success at all costs. Let's become a legend in our own time, they said. Let's climb to the top. We want to be king of the mountain. It's that inability to control the number of 12-hour days. It's that lack of discipline that overcommits to one aspect of life. It's that increasing ease with which those little distortions and lies creep into our work and word. To develop a dependence on God, to become balanced people, we have to have a sense of self-discipline. There has to be some minimizing of our expectations of ourselves and of others. To constantly demand of ourselves or of our family or of our friends or our workers goals and expectations that are out of reach and are fed by greed and pride and selfishness is to become an unbalanced person, unable to properly function in life. To hold debts over people's heads because they can't pay makes relationships into contracts, stifles love and appreciation, and discourages any kind of gratitude. Smalley, in the book that I pointed out earlier, says that this element, this lack of self-control, often ruins a good marriage. He tells of counseling with a Ben and a Sue. Sue always wanted a little bit more than what Ben could provide. And every time he bought her something, it either wasn't enough or it was too late. And when he finally did please her, she would respond by saying, well, it's about time. Well, finally, Sue got the message. She saw what she was doing, and she lowered her expectations, and the relationship improved. Gerson Keeler has a book out called Prairie Home Companion, and in it he tells of Florian and Myrtle Kreisbach, who live in Lake Wobegon. They're so predictable that every Friday night of their married lives, she cooks the same meal, breaded fish fillets. And they sit down to those fish fillets every Friday night. Florian takes his first bite and he savors it. He says, ah, it's the best you've ever done. And then he finds something different to compliment about her breaded fish fillet, something he hadn't noticed over the past 47 years in the meal. Keeler points out that's about 2,500 different compliments for breaded fish fillets. Well, that's not the sort of spirit we find in the tower construction site in Genesis 11. And unfortunately, it's often lacking in our own lives, a sense of satisfaction, a sense of self-discipline, a sense of contentment with life. It doesn't mean an end to our dreams or our goals, but it means a renewed sense of appreciation for the current level of our lives and for the people who make them meaningful. We've all finished a Thanksgiving celebration over the last couple of days. There was a custom in New England for a number of years that on Thanksgiving, the host or the hostess would put 5 grains of corn on each plate around the table before any of the food was served. It was a reminder of the first Thanksgiving that during those days, there was just 5 grains of corn rationed out per person, per meal, per day. Times were tight at those first Thanksgiving. Well, that's not a bad custom. It, instead of fixating us on a world that demands more and more, it reminds us that all of us could live on less than we have. And that the reason that we do as well as we do is because others have sacrificed so that we could. I'm not sure how that plays out in each one of our lives. One of the people I admire most in this church recently found his business expanding. He could see it was going to take more of his time. But what he did was to hire another employee. It meant less profit. It meant less money for his wage. It meant cost him and others, other areas, insurance and overhead. But he decided he couldn't be the kind of father, he couldn't be the kind of Christian he wanted to be unless he made that move. Well, that's not to recommend that procedure without restriction for everybody, but it is to say here's a model of somebody exercising discipline, lowering expectations, accepting a more limited lifestyle with the recognition that there are some things more important in life than ambition. The story was told about a man who had made a fortune by himself. Someone came up, noted to him that his success in life was really due to God and to others. He denied it. Said, I started with nothing. Nobody helped me along the way. Everything I got by myself. The person came back and said, how far would you have gone in your business if you'd never learned to read and write? The man said, not far. And he lowered his eyes and his head and acknowledged that he had valuable assets. They had been valuable assets and others had been valuable assets to his success. Well, a sense of gratitude and discipline is what's missing, or part of what's missing in Genesis 11. The bankruptcy of their scheme is something that we continue to feel in our own time. We live, some say, perhaps quite rudely, in a generation of swine, a world that demands more and more. A society tells us to get out and get it, get what you want, to make your own way, to push, to pull, to invest in order to get what you want in life. And Genesis 11 suggests that there's another direction that we can go. Robert Fulghum's book, All I Needed to Know, I Learned in Kindergarten, he tells of a V.P. Menon. Menon moved to India from England just after the end of World War II. Democracy was being established there. He wanted to be part of it. When he arrived, he found that his luggage, his money, his identification papers had all been stolen. He was there in a foreign land without a penny to his name. He found an Indian Sikh and asked him if he could borrow 15 rupees. The man agreed, loaned him the money. And then Menon wanted to write down the man's name and address so he could return the loan when he got back on his feet. The old Sikh said, that's not necessary. You borrowed it from a stranger. You return it to a stranger. Every time you see somebody in life that needs some money, that's when you repay the loan. Well, V.P. Menon became a wealthy man. He also was known for his great generosity because every time he saw someone in need, he would pay them back that loan that he had received. His daughter tells that when he was on his dying deathbed, someone came to the door, a beggar, boils and sores on his feet, no shoes or sandals, needed 15 rupees to buy a new pair of shoes. Menon instructed his daughter to go to his wallet, pull out the 15 rupees and hand it to the man. It was his last conscious act. Well, maybe 15 rupees, it may be $15, it may be a simple thank you, or it may be a conscious act of discipline by which expectations are lowered. But it's all part of the life that God calls us to. And when they're missing, we get increasingly miserable and frustrated about life. But the more they're there, the more, like the psalmist said, we begin to depend upon God. I know that a number of you have been studying the Bible this year. You've been learning about God. You've come to be believers in God. It may be today is the day to go public with that belief, to confess Jesus as Savior, to announce that you've given up the old life, put them on in baptism. Or there may be some here who have been thinking about realigning their life, dedicating themselves again to God. That I need to go public with this, let other people know where I am, where I have been, where I need to be. If we can help you meet one of those spiritual needs, why don't you do that right now?